Before we get into today's episode, it's Daniel here and we've got Lydia as well.
Hi.
And we've got some exciting news from Redchurch.
We do. So locally here at Redchurch in Melbourne, Australia, we are hiring.
Yeah, come on.
Yes, we have two new roles. First of all, a pastor of university students and an assistant pastor of university student outreach. We have been sensing for a long time that God is really moving and building a hunger in younger people. And we're seeing that particularly in the university space. And we've been asking, what would it look like for us to invest in this area? And God, if this is something that you want, you're going to have to make it possible.
Yeah.
So we've actually received partnership funding, which is allowing us to advertise and employ for these roles.
Yeah. So if you have a gift of evangelism and a real heart for this type of ministry or know someone who does, we would love to invite you to apply. You can head to redchurch.org.au/jobs to find out a bit more and how to apply.
We cannot wait to hear from you. Today on Rebuilders, we catch up on a few things that have been happening since we last recorded.
There is a lot happening in the world, from the impending US election, the biggest election in the world, the Indian election. We have Gaza, Palestine, Israel, JK Rowling won, the First Minister of Scotland nil. How do we understand all of these different dynamics and how do we have a lens to interpret them this year? We're going to look at perhaps what if underneath all of these events, there is a deeper rumbling of a break in our order as we have known it.
Yeah, really interesting stuff that we cover in this episode. So we will get into it. Welcome to Rebuilders. My name is Liddy and I'm here with Mark and Daniel. How are you guys?
Good. I'd like to welcome you, Liddy.
Yes.
Because we've had a change of personnel. Liddy Pickens is no longer part of our team. We would like to say hello to what I think is one of the coolest names out there, Liddy Lowe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Liddy Lowe.
Hi, Liddy Lowe.
Hi. It's also meant that all of my the stuff on my computer is no longer syncing because I updated my name. So here we are.
That's worth it. It's the coolest name out there. But welcome back after this little break we've had. You've gotten married, as regular listeners will know. And
yes,
it was great to have the whole Rebuilders team there at the wedding.
Yeah. It was really fun. Thank you both for what you did on the day. Really appreciate it.
Well, there was no leotard, as we joked last time.
Yeah.
Daniel looked very dapper, didn't wear a leotard. Although there was a bit, I think, where there was that brought up in your wedding speech? There was a joke where...
Oh, yeah, Stephen mentioned it.
Stephen mentioned it.
Oh, yeah.
And Daniel stood up and pretended to rip off his suit and expose a leotard underneath. It was just great. No, it was just
special
fantastic.
Times.
None of that.
But I did have a bone to pick.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I know. Look, it was an incredible day. Everything was perfect. But
so much work went into it.
So much work went into it, which I'm sure you're relieved that it's over now.
Oh, my goodness, I really am.
But I did have a bone to pick with you. You'd gone by this stage.
Yes.
And you and Stephen had left. And I think even Daniel, you'd headed home. And so, you know, there was a bit of dance floor happening. And
Were you on the dance floor, Mark?
No, I was performing a very important task. So as the dancing ended, there is the bit which is a key part of the wedding reception, the throwing of the bouquet, which is your duty, Liddy.
Look,
to do.
I refuse to do that.
Well, I saw disappointment. I saw an angry crowd of women gathering, and I took matters into my own hands, and I got the bouquet, and I threw the bouquet. And I'm just going to say this: Stephen's eyes were watering when you walked down the the aisle, as a vision of beauty. But it was good. But it didn't compare to the vision of beauty of the arc, the distribution. People were literally crying when they saw how I threw that bouquet, and it made my day because that's really what the day was about.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Who did you throw it to?
Well, yeah. you don't throw it to anyone. You want to get a great
so
arc.
You just found a bouquet of flowers.
And no,
Mark's been waiting for this moment his entire life.
It was the bridal bouquet. It
wasn't the bridal bouquet. It was a different
table,
one.
Okay, well, that's disputed, but we'll talk about that after. It was a bouquet because the real one wasn't there. It needed to be there. But anyway, you turn your back and you've got to get a great arc. And you wanted to land it in the ruck of women waiting. I can't remember who got it.
So there was actually
There
was women there.
I have a video of it.
This was real.
It's not you just going.
2 days after
the
wedding, I received a video that just said, "Oh, you might want to know that this happened after you left."
Did you take this upon yourself, or were you
someone? I think I was perhaps. Perhaps I was sort of, you know,
invited to do it,
mansplaining how this should be done. And then they're like, I was invited to do it myself. And I just said, get out of the way. It's time for the professionals.
Oh, wow. A friend of mine commented that Mark was surprisingly impressive at throwing the bouquet.
No, I wasn't surprised.
Been practicing all week.
Yeah. Some things come naturally.
They do. Well, yeah. I'm so glad that my wedding day provided you the opportunity to shine.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. It was my day to shine.
Oh, that's incredible.
Oh, good times. There was really good fish too.
Joking aside, the fish was insane.
Yeah.
Really good.
Mm-hmm. Mm. My friend's going to try and get the recipe.
Do it. Mm.
Yeah.
I also really like that you had trivia.
Yeah, there was a trivia.
Yeah, I know.
That was warmed my heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, it brought me great joy as well.
Yeah, well done.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyway, good times.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us this week, guys.
And we're done.
Wedding report. Yeah.
We are really thrilled to be back at the microphones and recording again. Obviously, when we have a couple of weeks off, there's a lot of things that happen in the world, a lot of things that we could be talking about. As always with Rebuilders, we try to step back and look at the more broader brushstrokes of what's going on in order to understand what's actually happening in culture, what's happening across the world. So, Mark, kick us off.
Well, I've had a lot of people reaching out and asking, to address different things going on in the world. Got the US presidential election coming up later in the year. Mm-hmm. Currently, I think voting is happening in the Indian election, which is just the most incredible exercise. A billion people. You've got the ongoing war in Gaza, but also protests around the Gaza moon, which are capturing a lot of news attention. All kinds of things. J.K. Rowling versus Hamza Yousef, the First Minister of Scotland. Just so many different things happening. People said, can you mention something about this? And I thought instead of mentioning them in individual senses, I wanted to talk about, a broader trend that is actually happening that I think is driving a lot of these issues, perhaps not driving them, but shapes how we see them. And I think this is a helpful interpretive analytical tool to view what will be more events to come as the year unfolds. I just finished over the last couple of weeks, as we've been in our break, a biography that was written by the biographer Ronald Steele of the eminent American columnist Walter Lippmann, who lived in really the 20th century. He was probably the most influential columnist in America and shaped the political thought of both parties, leaders all across Europe, and really was like almost the sort of horse whisperer to leaders of the world about how they should view the world. He started as a socialist in New York City, but through his column began to sort of envision as the chaos of the 1920s and 30s began, coming out of the First World War, pandemic, Spanish flu, the Great Depression, what you saw is extremism began to rise. This period that the world had lived through before World War I, which is a period of relative peace, at least in the Western world, seemed to cave into this new world where it's like the old ideologies, almost religious in nature, of nationalism, fascism, communism, threatened to overrun a lot of democratic countries.
Yeah.
And so through his columns and some of his writing, Walter Lippmann almost proposed a new way of running society where sort of rational centrists, a sort of leadership of experts would actually run these big questions. You know, there was a real sense after Adolf Hitler had been voted into power in a democratic election that, hang on, what if we can't trust democracy in the same way? What if the people are too susceptible to sort of the animal passions and will find themselves acting in irrational ways? And there was this sense of almost the mob had taken over. So he begins to sketch out week after week, I think he did a couple of columns a week, again and again, meeting with people, this vision where, yeah, you'd have this new, very centrist, smart people would run everything.
Mm.
Now, this vision very much, you know, I think has been central to both the left and the right, you know, from particularly after World War II right up until recently. You know, a lot of the complaints about our current moment of populism is really an argument to go back to this form of governing. And so what we're living through is that phase, again, going back into crisis and returning to something of what he was trying to fight against the 1920s and 30s, a fall into extremism. Now, there's an interesting line that is argued by the British political thinker William Davies, and he says something interesting, and I can't remember if we've mentioned this before, but if we have, I want to talk about it in a different way. Secularism is effectively the attempt to disenchant society, take away the enchantment of religion, faith, superstition, belief, and just look at the world through a rational sort of scientific basis.
Mm.
And what Davies argued, there'd been another kind of disenchantment. He said that what had happened is in the 1970s and 80s, as the economy became central to the world and the market took over everything, that there was this disenchantment of politics. And if you think about politics really, if you go back to the original Greek word, is the art of the city, the polis. It's about relational chatting through what are the issues affecting your community. It's about compromise, negotiation, sitting down with your opponents, seeing others in good faith, and almost this vision of people who are morally sound and trustworthy, you know, then nutting this all out together.
Mm, it's certainly not the picture that we have of politics exactly. Now.
And what he said was that in this place, it's almost like sort of marketing, imagery, slogans, competition took over. And so what has happened is that sort of world that Lippmann envisioned has been completely disenchanted. Politics as we understood it is out the window. We're in a new environment now, which people would argue is hyper-political. I think what Davies is arguing here, it's not political enough. It's actually something else. And so this dynamic, I think, is actually operating behind so many of these other trends that we're seeing in the world and are concerned by.
Yeah, okay. So this this disenchantment of the political space creates new dynamics.
Yes.
Right? So the first one that you want to talk about and you've already kind of mentioned is it empowers extremists.
Yes.
That there's this sort of fall into extremism that's happening.
When you do politics in its purest sense, and this is not just true at a political national level, this is when you have to talk through something in a church, talk through something in a family. You sit down with other people, you hear out your opponents, you try and come to some kind of middle ground. Everyone must approach that realizing that they have to compromise something. This is marriage, this is friendship, this is local town politics. And, you know, when that goes, and in a sense, particularly also in our very much digital platform-driven society, you can talk to other people, you can post about them, you can label others in particular ways when you're not sitting down in a face-to-face engagement with them. So the disenchantment of politics has actually seen the rise of extremists. If you look at a lot of political parties now, they're having to deal with this extremist wings of their parties. It seems like these voices, which were often, you know, marginalized. So, for example, now you've had far right, you know, groups at different times march through our city and it gets on the news. They're able to promote that through social media and maybe just 20 guys in, you know, balaclavas, but it creates this fear in the community. Now, they were still doing that 30 years ago. There were skinheads rocking around, but they didn't have video cameras. They didn't have this environment where that message could go viral. And what you see is that extremism is becoming something that when we don't have the tools to sit down with people, grows everywhere. Let's just look at Gaza for one example and Palestine. You know, part of the reason that we are where we are is that there's this incredibly complex dynamic that is finding a solution to the problem of Palestine and Israel. It is one of the most difficult things to sort of deal with. But what you have is you have two forces in Israel and Palestine at the moment who are leading the countries. You have, you know, mm-hmm. the government of Benjamin Netanyahu, who, as he's gotten into his political problems, has had to make sort of to get a coalition in the Likud, in the Israeli parliament, having to make deals with the more extremists in his party. And, you know, a lot of these are from the sort of further extremes of the sort of Zionist movement, the some of them settler movement, which sees that some of the land that's been given to Palestinians actually is rightfully theirs. And some of the sort of, you know, rhetoric that comes from these people is extremely, you know, is extremely extremist and, you know, is very much based around this sort of like taking of this particular land. There's no room for compromise. Anyone who compromises, you know, must be, you know, restricted. So he's politically in bed with these people. And at the same time in Palestine, in Gaza, you have a leadership, which is a, you know, this political slash militant group called Hamas, you know, which again to pursues an extremist agenda. It's effectively a militant terrorist group backed by Iran and one of the sort of proxies of Iran, which has this very radical extremist view. So you've got two groups of extremists, you know, battling each other. You then have this dynamic where naturally this engenders protests as people see what they feel like Israel's over, you know, militaristic, damaging response to the attacks of October 7th. But often at the front of these movements are people who, yes, they're interested in what's going on in Gaza, but it's part of a bigger political struggle that they're part of. You know, a lot of the leaders of these organizations, you know, really their goal is much more of a sort of Marxist revolutionary, you know, sort of standpoint. So they're not interested in necessarily a compromised solution that a lot of political leaders around the world have tried to pursue for decades now with Israel and Palestine. The two-state solution that many people suggest, they don't want that, you know, that they see this as a tool to not just create a sort of revolutionary movement around Palestine, but see that in the societies that they're also in. Is that every person in the protest? No. Is it, is it, you know, 10%? Maybe even less. But these people are very skilled at running these protests. And you also have counter protests, often even on the Israeli side, who also have other goals, you know, to push back against this. You see people using this as a truncheon to bash people around Islamic migration or Arabic migration to the West. So what you have is these conversations, which are extremely difficult to have, which need compromise, which need people to sit down, which need to have settlements, is almost our ability to have those things now is almost impossible. You know, there were peace meetings happening at Camp David and, you know, in all these, you know, sort of meetings happening over the years. They don't happen because extremists now in this sort of disenchanted space are running things and they will push it. There's something about social media and this moment which pushes it to the most extreme version. So, for example, early on you couldn't, you know, people were saying, that's fine, you're interested in the cause of the Palestinians and you think it's an overzealous reaction from Israel, but just don't praise Hamas. In this environment, people go, well, I'm going to praise Hamas then. Everything goes to these absolute extremes. And if you even watch some of the sort of sentiment on Israeli television, you know, you'll see some of the settler movements, you know, talk about sort of eradicating and taking back, you know, sort of Gaza and turning it into, you know, some sort of seaside resorts for, you know, Israeli people. So everything goes to the extremes. And this current environment takes power away from those who want compromise and takes it to the extremes.
Okay. So, I mean, yeah, this, what you've just mentioned kind of leads into the next one, that this disenchantment with the political space drives social chaos and unrest.
Yes. Well, when your demands then are extreme, and to an extremist, they might not seem extreme. They might seem like this is the ultimate thing that we want. There's a utopian element to this. Now, part of one of the problems with Walter Lippmann's vision about this society where the experts run is the experts got into a bit of hubris where we've talked about this before, where particularly coming into the 90s and the early 2000s, there was this sense of like, hang on, that order was very much in power and it looked like the world was going to, after the fall of communism, it looked like the world could move to this almost utopian moment. So all of a sudden, you know, for example, in our state here in Victoria, the goal of the Traffic Accident Commission has been very successful. We've got one of the lowest road death tolls in the world. Mm. But I think it was about 10 years ago, they came up with a goal, which was we're going to have no one die on the road at all.
Yeah.
And Frank Ferretti in his book, The Kingdom of Fear or Culture of Fear, talks about the fact that you have these government agencies saying we can get rid of all accidents, full stop. So not a single worker will die, you know, in certain industries. Is that a noble goal? Yes. Is it practical? Probably not. Mm. So instead of like, let's go for the lowest road toll in the world, we're not going, no one's going to die on the road. Yeah. You know. So how do you do that?
Yes.
So as the sort of centrist Walter Lippmann vision of, you know, a sort of technocracy of experts began to get into this hubristic moment, it then put in people's minds, hang on, we can achieve everything. You know, those who are going for the Palestinian cause can get everything they want. Those who are going for the Israeli cause, you know, can get everything they want. Mm. And this destroyed the ability to have compromise. But what that means is we're then left with ongoing intractable problems. Mm. The persistence of sexism, racism, conflict in the world, economic inequality. These problems go from things that we should be working at because they're justice issues to things which we can solve. Now, the utopianness of that is being exposed in this moment. Mm. And so you don't actually solve problems. You constantly talk about them. You don't get there, and that is driving continual social chaos and unrest. Mm. In our community.
Okay. Another one.
Mm.
It distances us from real world solutions, pushing us into ideology. What do you mean by that?
So again, too, as extremists are empowered, as you sort of have this interesting combination, which is like the remnant spirit of the centrist vision lives on in these extreme environments that, you know, almost the Obama vision, which is perhaps the last incarnation of that sort of centrist mm. thing of, yes, we can, then goes into the centrist things and is applied to extremist causes. It then just gets to very simplistic slogans.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and very simplistic responses. We're in a national conversation here in Australia around domestic violence. We've had a number mm. of sort of high profile and very tragic killings of women by men. One was particularly at Bondi Junction Mall recently. A number of women were killed by a guy with a knife. And so there's this national conversation. And in this environment, this is clearly an issue that needs to be discussed. Now, our National Football League, the Australian Football League, you know, at the moment, as I looked at the newspaper this morning, you know, there's pressure on them to make a statement saying that, you know, about domestic violence.
Yeah.
Is that a bad thing in and of itself? No. But what's interesting is they'll probably do that and say, we're against domestic violence. And that's almost the belief today. If everyone just says this and everyone makes a stand, this thing will go away. Now, what's really interesting, because our sort of National Football League is a local game, it's an Indigenous game of Australian rules football, it can't get a lot of international funding like the NBA gets or the British, you know, the English Premier League. So it's got to rely on, it wants to hit at a national level, so it's got to get funding at that sort of international scale. And one of the ways it's done that is through gambling, massive gambling. It's crazy the amount of gambling ads and young men, teenagers that are connected to gambling. Now, the data actually says that there's a strong correlation between those who are indebted gambling and high uses of gambling, and particularly online gambling, and the men who do that, and even to the age from 30 to 39, particular socioeconomic environments, and then who are drinking a lot and also using gambling apps. Mm. Now, probably the most practical thing that our National Football League could do would actually to, maybe make a statement, but actually say, well, as a result of the data, we're going to reject this gambling money or we're going to severely limit it. Mm. That doesn't happen because they've got this entrenched thing.
Sure.
So we're in this weird situation where they're probably going to make a statement in the next few days, but it's actually not going to get to the root cause of some of these issues. Mm-hmm. So we get in this weird stage, and this has been everywhere in the last few years, and it's complex because on one stance, you want people to make a stand, and particularly when people are hurting and whether it's a minority group who feels ignored or their suffering is ignored, it's helpful to hear people making a stand. Yet at the same time, it can also be a way of some of those entrenched in power not actually taking a stand.
Yes.
And a non-costly stand, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And what this does is it ends up promoting simplistic answers rather than actually responding to complex environments.
Yes.
Now, we've spoken before about the difference between a complicated world and a complex world.
Yeah.
A complicated world is linear. You have a problem, you solve it, you move on to the next problem. We're dealing with multiplicity of problems. The issue of domestic violence is linked to 100% sexism. Mm-hmm. But it's also linked to the economy.
Yep.
It's linked to living costs. It's linked to extreme pornography. It's linked to gambling. It's linked to the amount that someone's been, you know, connected to the prison system. There is a multiplicity of things going on. Gaza is exactly the same. Gaza yeah. and Palestine is one of the most complex things that, yes, there's a two-state solution is the answer, but the Sunni states don't want a Hamas-controlled, Iranian-backed state on Israel's doorstep. The Jordanians have a large Palestinian population, which in the past has gone to war with them. There's this Iranian Saudi axis battle going on. There's an America is under pressure from a lot of people in its country to not sell arms, but it doesn't want Iran to then have a foothold. All of these problems exist in this web of a multiplicity of issues around them. And that's really complex for the average person to understand.
Yes.
And this was partly what Walter Lippmann was arguing. And I'm not here to push Walter Lippmann's thought pattern, but there's a truth there that some of these problems are so big that the smartest people in the world can't understand them. But a simplistic sort of answer feels like we're cutting through on them. But that works for a bit. Like that worked in things like perhaps, you know, make poverty history. But the more that was used, those sort of sloganeering,
yeah,
it's a cacophony of them.
And then
you
just,
you start to get disillusioned because none of this stuff is working. We're constantly talking about it. Nothing gets better. And in Australia, you know, people are going, well, hang on, domestic violence has gotten worse after these 10 years of talking about this and prevention. So that brings disillusionment to people.
Yeah. Your final point that you wanted to make about what the dynamics of a disenchanted political space looks like is that it undermines plausibility structures.
Yeah.
So maybe before you dive into this, for those who aren't familiar with the concept of plausibility structures, maybe just give a bit of context for them.
Yeah, so plausibility structures, Peter Berger talked about this, that belief, if you believe in something, it has to exist in this sort of structure of others believing that it offers you answers to have a better life. You know, like if you went to a gym, say, or a nutritionist and they promised to help you lose weight or get healthier and you're just gaining weight and becoming more unhealthier every week as you follow these people's program, there's going to be a point where you start to doubt the plausibility of this structure.
Yep.
So plausibility structure is others are believing it. You're part of this social imaginary, to use Charles Taylor's term, but also that it's actually making real world difference in your life. But when institutions and ideologies stop seemingly working, it rocks people.
Yep.
And it rocks their view of the world. They lose a sense of security. So what's happened is we've promoted a lot of imagery in the world. That's been a lot of driven by ideology. This happens on the left and the right.
Mm-hmm.
And we've promoted these ideologies to serve real world problems.
Yep.
But we're seeing that, hang on, these are not making a difference in the world.
Mm.
So, for example, a classic one at the moment is the US economy. People are saying the US economy is doing great. Look at the figures, you know, like the economy is growing. Yet ordinary people are saying, hang on, I don't feel that.
Mm.
And people are saying, well, Biden should be ahead because the economy is growing. And normally when the economy is growing, a president, you know, wins.
Mm.
Why are people not feeling that? Well, because actually the economy is growing, but a lot of that growth is happening to the top 1%.
Yes.
Biden did the Inflation Reduction Act, which was a lot of money being stimulated into manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
So certain parts of the economy, particularly tech, are growing. But then ordinary people are facing, you know, inflation, which has gone down a little bit. But again, to what is inflation? Is it you're talking about what someone's paying for a loaf of bread, you know, or is it inflation on, you know, what someone in a Tesla factory has to pay for piece of robotics equipment.
Yeah.
So what's actually happening is we'd be told these things constantly, that if we do these things, the world will get better. The economy is actually good, but it doesn't feel like it. And what this is doing, they're just, you know, a couple of examples that actually the legitimacy starts to go. I mentioned J.K. Rowling and the First Minister of Scotland, Hamza Youssef, at the beginning, the Scottish Nationalist Party, which was the party which was, you know, sort of set up to bring Scottish independence, they lost the referendum. Mm-hmm. And after they lost the referendum, they sort of, you know, really branded themselves as a sort of progressive party, almost like the Greens or whatever. And one of the things they brought in was this online hate bill or a hate bill where basically anyone who perhaps misgendered someone or these sort of terms, then that was a police matter which could be prosecuted. And all of a sudden, you just had this sea of complaints. J.K. Rowling was one of the people who sort of challenged this. So you had this fascinating battle between the creator of Harry Potter and the First Minister of Scotland. Who's more powerful? It was a thing between, you know, platform power and political power. And the police, Scottish police came out and said, like, we are so overrun with dealing with this stuff. We're not going to be able to do normal policing. Mm. So yesterday, the First Minister of Scotland resigned because their political legitimacy was lost at that point. And we're seeing this across the world. You're seeing a lot of governments who spoke a lot in these very utopian tones are actually losing their legitimacy. But that's happening everywhere. It's happening more than just in left-wing politics, that everywhere there is this sense that there is this legitimacy crisis. What are we to believe anymore? Yeah, the world feels topsy-turvy since 2016. There's this sense that things turned on their head. And what happens then is you think that that would necessarily return to the center. That's happening in some places. So, for example, in places like San Francisco or, you know, Portland, where after the last couple of years, there was a lot of complaints that law and order, you know, had fallen over, people were leaving the city, the economy was getting hit, you know, and some of that was linked to things like decriminalizing drugs. You've seen a recriminalizing of drugs in, I think it's some of the San Francisco mayoral elections after the mayor, London Breed, who terms up, that there's even candidates who are Democrats talking about part of their platform is to bring the National Guard onto the streets in New York. National Guard's been sent into the subway. And, you know, there's this sense in that there's a course correction that often happens. Sometimes it's in the opposite extreme. But also what happens is the more we get into this realm, the more people look for even more ideological, metaphysical, and almost religious answers. It's almost like the extremism breeds more extremism.
Yes.
Someone who's questioning things all of a sudden, you know, goes down a rabbit hole and ends up even more extreme. So what we're sort of seeing is this driving element where this process is being intensified as it reacts against itself. So what does this mean? What does it mean when the plausibility structures begin to change? Again, I've said a million times on here, prediction is a mug's game, but I'm going to predict something. I think underneath the surface, unseen, there is a serious rupture coming. A lot of the dynamics that you observe when serious change comes to cultures are in play. There's Jeffrey Hosking in his book about Russia, and there's a chapter where he talks about the conditions that came before the Russian Revolution. He talked about economic inequality. He also talked about the fact that when you have a lot of young men who are not employed, who are not connected into responsibility families, a connective tissue, there's a revolutionary potential in that environment. I think the issue of domestic violence in Australia is a huge one. It may be also linked across the world to a bigger issue of the potential for violence in societies, full stop. When the cost of living becomes an increasing dynamic, when young people look forward and go, I'm never going to be able to afford a house, I'm never going to be able to afford a life that's better than my parents, the plausibility structure of so much of the developed world starts to break down. Also, what happens is you tend to have an escalation at play. So, extremism escalates because if I can't believe in the previous, you know, things that I once believed in, I need to find somewhere to land, and not all the places that people are going to land are going to be good.
Yeah.
And what happens at that point, that the sirens call of those who do offer answers to why things are falling over. It's all well and good getting annoyed at people about conspiracy theories and populism, but conspiracy theories and populism emerge from pre-existing social conditions where promises have been broken. And people feel let down and feel marginalized, and they look for someone to offer a compelling story. And I think what people didn't realize is one of the problems from our last era is that centrism got extremist.
Yeah. Well,
firstly, it became extremist and it said, well, there's nothing bigger in life. You know, if you just shop and, you know, buy an ice cream on Saturday, that's going to deal with all your great human longings. It doesn't. That was extremist in of itself. But I sort of get that, because what I was trying to do is that tradition comes out of, you know, seeing how extremism grows quickly, a world where the Great Depression, war tore us apart. So there's a sense where let's just turn the dial down on extremist beliefs. If you want to believe that stuff in your private life, you want to worship freely, do that, free speech, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we saw, you know, the terrible attacks of 9/11 then created this extremist response in the rise of a massive surveillance state. We saw that one of the answers to that was a war in Iraq, which was, I think, devastating and came from an extremist vision of that people in the Middle East would just want to happily accept a liberal democracy, and all they really want to do is just drink Coke, you know, at the local, I don't know, disco or something. And what is this, 1979? you know, they have tribal connections. There's religious connections. There's deeper stuff, you know, that the liberal West couldn't see because we'd stop believing in it. You know, I think that the extreme versions of the economy that caused the global financial crash of 2008 came from an extremist view of the world. So in a sense, you know, some people might yearn for a return to centrism, but I think that world's not coming back because it itself drifted into extremism. Mm. And so, you know, people see that and they see, well, hang on, is now the establishment just wanting to give fealty to Wall Street and the industrial military complex? So people are profoundly disillusioned. And I just think that this doesn't just remain boiling as a pot on the back of the stove, that there's got to be some reaction to this. So I think there's a juncture happening that may be political, that may be a conflict, that may be rebellions, revolutions in certain places. Europe is turning to the hard right. Central Europe is looking beyond liberal democracy back to sort of forms of cultural Christianity. In India, you know, India as a modern state was created as this sort of secular republic that wasn't secular and no one believed anything. More it was, we're not going to put one religion above others. Current election will probably be won by Narendra Modi, and his vision is of a Hindu nationalism, which is deeply centered around a very sort of, I think, extreme version of Hinduism, which is marginalizing Muslims and Christians, creating divide between North and South India. The strong medicine is back. And it's going to take a form. And so one thing I'd say to people is, you know, Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz learned that her and Toto weren't in Kansas anymore. We are not in 2015 anymore. This is a radically different world. Whatever your investment is in the world, you may be a pastor, you may work in politics, you may work at your local hardware store, whatever you do as your vocation, as creating the image of God in this world, is we need to adapt that there's going to be change. Now, people hear this and go, you talk about the war, you know, the Civil War movie, is this apocalyptic? I'm not necessarily saying that, but things in the future are going to be different. Now, one possibility that opens up this time is an opening to the spiritual. I've said it and I'll keep saying it till I'm blue in the face, and I'll keep coming back every week and saying this. Crisis precedes renewal. Is it going to be everyone? No. Is that going to insulate us from some of these political turmoils? No. But I just get the sense that underneath the surface, I'll talk about this more maybe in our next episode, but you know, it's interesting. I think it was Ross Barkin wrote an article in The Guardian saying, like, coming out of COVID, something had changed and people need to be attuned. He saw online in Gen Z a massive interest in the occult, astrology, the rational, believe the science sort of thing that Walter Lippmann centrism wanted us to connect to after the pandemic. There's a lot of people not going down that path. There is a hunger for bigger explanation. We need to be attuned to that because it's not going to snap back to normal. What does the future look like? I don't know exactly, but it's going to be different. So how do we respond to that as the people of God in the world at this time? And how do we also not fall to the siren's call of some of this stuff of extremism ourselves?
I think as you were just in that last little section there, Mark, I was thinking about how, you know, this idea of not continuing to rely on those plausibility structures because they're no longer reliable. I was kind of picturing like scaffolds, but like different pieces of the scaffold had been replaced with, I don't know, like breadsticks or something. And so they're just like, they look like they were good, but they're starting to fall apart. Anyway, my point was that the real question that we potentially need to be asking is, what is my foundation?
Yes.
Like, what am I relying on? Yes, the world is changing, but what isn't changing? What is the foundation from which I live that can then respond to all of these things as they change and shift and appear to be quite chaotic and extreme? Where's my center?
Yes.
Oh,
great point. And it's interesting. I think of Augustine's City of God book, which, you know, is magnum opus and massive book. And really what that book is about is the Roman Empire appears to be going to decline. And it's interesting. There's this nuanced response to the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was brutal, militaristic. It colonized huge parts of the world. It was a massive imperial power that worshipped pagan deities. Yet also the Christians realized that it persecuted them, but also brought a stability and an order, which meant that the Roman roads were often open. Paul could travel on his apostolic journeys. The letters of Peter and Paul could go around the Roman world, and it provided some sense of protection. But as it began to go into decline, Augustine is having this conversation where he is sort of saying, yeah, this thing's falling, but where is ultimately our foundation? Is it in the city of God or the city of man, as he calls it in that book? And I think we're at that moment. You know, I don't think it's as extreme as the fall of the Roman Empire, but there's a reason behind the meme of lots of guys obsessed with the Roman Empire. I think it's not obsessed with the Roman Empire. I think it's obsessed with the fall of the Roman Empire, because we see parallels in that to this moment. And so I think that, again, you know, there's an opportunity in this moment. I just want to add one more point. Also, that centrist era of, you know, which went right up to, say, let's say 2015, also said, you're an individual, you're empowered, you can do it all, you can change the world, you're special. And so part of we've brought that into these realization that as we're in a connected world, you see the child whose house has been destroyed in Gaza, your heart breaks, you see the person on the other side of the world suffering. You see the reality. You can read blog articles about the, you know, Wall Street and inequality. And so we're more informed. But also what that says to us, you're not as empowered as you thought. And so, yeah, what if Gaza is so unbelievably complex? You're not going to understand it all, but you're called to pray for it. We're called to still work for justice. But it actually creates a sort of a humility in us that we're not the central players in these things as we thought. But God is, and God is the God of history, and he's moving history towards his ends. So to understand where we fit in this, we need to align ourselves with him, realize our smallness, and that, you know, once Gaza's over, there'll be the next thing. You know, before Gaza was something else. We're going to be talking about whatever in 6 months' time. So there's a point of humility as well in this overlap between those two eras.
That's good. Well, it's been good to be back. Thank you for joining us for this episode. As always, we send out our subscriber chats to our subscribers. So if you would like to be a subscriber, you can head to rebuilders.co and sign up there. And we send out an email a few days after the episode is released, just with some background chat about the episode, things that have come up, things that we might have been thinking about as we were having discussion. So feel free to sign up for that, and we'll see you next week.